This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Kingdom of Childhood. This is Lecture 3, given in Torquay on August 14, 1924. Today we will characterize certain general principles of the art of education for the period between the change of teeth and puberty, passing on in the next lecture to more detailed treatment of single subjects and particular conditions that may arise. When children reach the 9th or 10th year, they begin to differentiate themselves from the environment. For the first time, there is a difference between subject and object. Subject is what belongs to oneself. Object is what belongs to another person or thing. Now you can begin to speak of external things as such, whereas before this time, you needed to treat them as though these external objects formed one whole together with the child's own body. I showed yesterday how you could speak of animals and plants, for instance, as though they were human beings who speak and act. The children thereby could have the feeling that the outside world is simply a continuation of their own being. When children have turned 9 or 10, you must introduce certain elementary facts of the outside world, the facts of the plant and animal kingdoms. Other subjects I shall speak of later. But it is particularly in this realm that you must be guided by what the children's own nature needs and asks. The first thing you have to do is to dispense with all the textbooks. For textbooks, as they are written at the present time, contain nothing about the plant and animal kingdoms that we can use in teaching. They are good for instructing grown-up people about plants and animals, but you will ruin the individuality of the child if you use them at school. And indeed, there are no textbooks or handbooks today that show how these things should be taught. Now, this is the important point. If you put single plants in front of the child and demonstrate different things from them, you are doing something that has no reality. A plant by itself is not a reality. If you pull out a hair and examine it as though it were a thing by itself, that would not be a reality either. In ordinary life, we say of everything of which we can see the outlines with our eyes that it is real. But if you look at a stone and form some opinion about it, that is one thing. If you look at a hair or a rose, it is another. In 10 years' time, the stone will be exactly as it is now, but in 2 days, the rose will have changed. The rose is only a reality together with the whole rose bush. The hair is nothing in itself, but is only a reality when considered with the whole head, as part of the whole human being. If you go out into the fields and pull up plants, it is as though you had torn out the hair of the earth. For the plants belong to the earth, just in the same way as the hair belongs to the organism of the human being. And it is senseless to examine a hair by itself, as though it could suddenly grow anywhere of its own accord. It is just foolish to take a botanical tin and bring home plants to be examined by themselves. This has no relation to reality, and such a method cannot lead one to a right knowledge of nature, or of the human being. Here we have a plant, and there is a drawing. But this alone is not the plant, for the soil beneath it also belongs to the plant, spread out on all sides and maybe a very long way. There are some plants that send out little roots a very long way. And when you realize that the small clod of earth containing the plant belongs to a much greater area of soil around it, then you will see how necessary it is to manure the earth in order to promote healthy plant growth. Something else is living besides the actual plant. This part here, below the line in the drawing, lives with it and belongs to the plant. The earth lives with the plant. There are some plants that blossom in the spring, about May or June, and bear fruit in autumn. Then they wither and die and remain in the earth that belongs to them. But there are other plants that take the earth forces out of their environment. If this is the earth, then the root takes into itself the forces around it, And because it has done so, these forces shoot upward and a tree is formed. For what is actually a tree? A tree is a colony of many plants. And it does not matter whether you are considering a hill that has less life in itself, but that has many plants growing on it, or a tree trunk where the living earth itself has, as it were, withdrawn into the tree. Under no circumstances can you understand any plant properly if you examine it by itself. If you go, preferably on foot, into a district where there are definite geological formations, let us say red sand, and look at the plants there, you will find that most of them have reddish-yellow flowers. The flowers belong to the soil. Soil and plant make up a unity, just as your head and your hair also make a unity. Therefore, you must not teach geography and geology by themselves, and then botany separately. That is absurd. Geography must be taught together, with a description of the country and observation of the plants, for the earth is an organism, and the plants are like the hair of this organism. Children must be able to see that the earth and the plants belong together, and that each portion of soil bears those plants that belong to it. Thus, the only right way is to speak of the plants in connection with the earth, and to give the children a clear feeling that the earth is a living being that has hair growing on it. The plants are the hair of the earth. People speak of the earth as having the force of gravity. This is spoken of as belonging to the earth. But the plants, with their force of growth, belong to the earth just as much. The earth and the plants are no more separate entities than a person and his or her hair would be. They belong together, just as the hair on the head belongs to the person. If you show children plants out of a botanical tin and tell them their names, you will be teaching something quite unreal. This will have consequences for their whole life. For this kind of plant knowledge will never give them an understanding, for example, of how the soil must be treated, and of how it must be manured, made living by the manure that is put into it. Children can only understand how to cultivate the land if they know how the soil is really part of the plant. People today have less and less conception of reality, the so-called practical people least of all, for they are really all theoretical, as I showed you in our first lecture. And because they have no longer any idea of reality, they look at everything in a disintegrated, isolated way. Thus it has come about that in many districts during the last 50 or 60 years, all agricultural products have become decadent. Not long ago there was a conference on agriculture in Central Europe where the agriculturists themselves admitted that crops are now becoming so poor that there is no hope of their being suitable for human consumption in 50 years' time. Why is this so? It is because people do not understand how to make the soil living by means of manure. It is impossible that they should understand it if they have been given conceptions of plants as being something in themselves, apart from the earth. The plant is no more an object in itself than a hair is. For if this were so, you might expect it to grow just as well in a piece of wax or tallow as in the skin of the head. But it is only in the head that it will grow. In order to understand how the earth is really a part of plant life, you must find out what kind of soil each plant belongs to. The art of manuring can only be arrived at by considering earth and plant as a unity, and by looking upon the earth as an organism, and the plant as something that grows with this organism. Thus children feel from the very start that they are standing on a living earth. This is of great significance for their whole life. For think what kind of conception people have today of the origin of geological strata. They think of it as one layer deposited upon another. But what you see as geological strata is only hardened plants, hardened living matter. It is not only coal that was formerly a plant, having its roots more in water rather than in firm ground and belonging completely to the earth, but also granite, gneiss, and so on were originally of plant and animal nature. This, too, one can understand only by considering earth and plants as one whole. And in these things it is not only a question of giving children knowledge, but of giving them also the right feelings about it. You come to see that this is so when you consider such things from the point of view of spiritual science. You may have the best will in the world. You may say to yourself that the child must learn about everything, including plants, by examining them, and at an early age encourage the child to bring home a nice lot of plants in a beautiful tin box. You examine them together because here is something real. You firmly believe that this is a reality, for it is, after all, an object lesson. But all the time you are looking at something that is not a reality at all. This kind of object lesson teaching of the present day is utter nonsense. This way of learning about plants is just as unreal as though it were a matter of indifference whether a hair grew in wax or in the human skin. It cannot grow in wax. Ideas of this kind are completely contradictory to what the child received in spiritual worlds before it descended to the earth. For there the earth looked quite different. This intimate relationship between the mineral earth kingdom and the plant world was then something that the child's soul could receive as a living picture. Why is this so? It is because, in order for human beings to incarnate at all, they have to absorb something that is not yet mineral, but is only on the way to becoming mineral, namely the etheric element. The child has to grow into the element of the plants, and this plant world appears to the child as related to the earth. This series of feelings that children experience when they descend from the pre-earthly world into the earthly world, this whole world of richness, is made confused and chaotic if it is introduced by the usual kind of botany teaching, whereas children rejoice inwardly if they hear about the plant world in connection with the earth. Similarly, we should consider how to introduce our children to the animal world. Even a superficial glance will show us that the animal does not belong to the earth. It runs over the earth and can be in this place or that. So the relationship of the animal to the earth is quite different from that of the plant. Something else strikes us about the animal. When we come to examine the different animals that live on the earth, let us say according to their soul qualities, first of all, we find cruel beasts of prey, gentle lambs, and animals of courage. Some of the birds are brave fighters, and we find courageous animals among the mammals, too. We find majestic beasts, like the lion. In fact, there is the greatest variety of soul qualities, and we characterize each single species of animal by saying that it has this or that quality. We call the tiger cruel, for cruelty is its most important and significant quality. We call the sheep patient. Patience is its most outstanding characteristic. We call the donkey lazy, because, although in reality it may not be so very lazy, yet its whole bearing and behavior somehow reminds us of laziness. The donkey is especially lazy about changing its position in life. If it happens to be in a mood to go slowly, nothing will induce it to go quickly. And so every animal has its own particular characteristics. But we cannot think of human beings in this way. We cannot think of one person as being only gentle and patient, another only cruel, and a third only brave. We should find it a very one-sided arrangement if people were distributed over the earth in this way. You do sometimes find such qualities developed in a one-sided way, but not to the same extent as in animals. Rather, what we find with human beings, especially when we are to educate them, is that there are certain things and facts of life that they must meet with patience, or again with courage, or, and other things and situations, even maybe with a certain cruelty, although cruelty should be administered in homeopathic doses. Or in certain situations, people may show cruelty simply out of their own natural development, and so on. Now, what is really the truth about these soul qualities of humans and animals? With humans, we find that they can really possess all qualities, or at least the sum of all the qualities that the animals have between them, each possessing a different one. Humans have a little of each one. They are not as majestic as the lion, but they have something of majesty within them. They are not as cruel as the tiger, but they have a certain cruelty. They are not as patient as the sheep, but they have some patience. They are not as lazy as the donkey, at least everybody is not, but they have some of this laziness in them. All human beings have these things within them. When we think of this matter in the right way, we can say that human beings have within them the lion nature, sheep nature, tiger nature, and donkey nature. They bear all these within them, but harmonized. All the qualities tone each other down, as it were, and the human being is the harmonious flowing together, or to put it more academically, the synthesis of all the different soul qualities that the animal possesses. The goal of the human being is to have the proper dose of lion-ness, sheep-ness, tiger-ness, donkey-ness, and so on. For all of these to be present in the right proportions and in the right relationships to everything else. A beautiful old Greek proverb says, "If courage be united with cleverness, it will bring thee blessing, but if it goes alone, ruin will follow." If I were only courageous with the courage of certain birds that are continually fighting, I would not bring much blessing into my life. But if my courage is so developed in my life that it unites with cleverness, the cleverness that in the animal is only one-sided, then it takes its right place in my being. With the human being, then, it is a question of a synthesis, an harmonizing of everything that is spread out in the animal kingdom. We can express it like this. Here is one kind of animal. I am representing it diagrammatically. Here a second, a third, a fourth, and so on. All the possible kinds of animals on the earth. How are they related to the human being? The relationship is such that the human being has, let us say, something of this first kind of animal, there's a drawing, but modified, not in its entirety. Then comes another kind, but again not the whole of it. This leads us to the next and to yet another, so that all animals are contained within the human being. The animal kingdom is the human being spread out, and the human being is the animal kingdom drawn together. All the animals are united synthetically in the human being, and if you analyze a human being, you get the whole human animal kingdom. This is also the case with the external human form. Imagine a human face and cut away part of it here, and there's a drawing, and pull another part forward here so that this latter part is not harmonized with the whole face, while the forehead recedes. Then you get a dog's head. If you form the head in a somewhat different way, you get a lion's head, and so on. And so with all the other organs, you can find that the human being's external figure has, in a modified, harmonized form, what is distributed among the animals. Think, for instance, of a waddling duck. You have a relic of this waddling part between your fingers, only shrunken. Thus everything that is to be found in the animal kingdom, even in external form, is present also in the human kingdom. Indeed, this is the way humans can find their relationship to the animal kingdom, by coming to know that the animals, taken all together, make up the human being. Human beings exist on Earth, 1,800 million of them, when this was written, now it's 6.5 billion, of greater or lesser value, but they exist again as a giant human being. The whole animal kingdom is a giant human being, not brought together in a synthesis, but analyzed out into single examples. It is as though you were made of elastic, that could be pulled out in varying degrees in different directions. If you were thus stretched out in one direction more than in others, one kind of animal would be formed. Or, again, if the upper part of your face were to be pushed up and stretched out, if it were sufficiently elastic, then another animal would arise. Thus humans bear the whole animal kingdom within them. This is how the history of the animal kingdom used to be taught in ancient times. This was a right and healthy knowledge. which has now been lost, though only comparatively recently. In the 18th century, for instance, people still knew that if the olfactory nerve of the nose is sufficiently large and extended backward, then it is a dog's nose. But if the olfactory nerve is shriveled up and only a small portion remains, the rest of it being metamorphosed, then there arises the nerve that we need for our intellectual life. For observe how a dog smells. The olfactory nerve is extended backward from the nose. A dog smells the special peculiarity of each thing. A dog does not make a mental picture of it, but everything comes to it through smell. A dog has not will and imagination, but has will and a sense of smell for everything, a wonderful sense of smell. A dog does not find the world less interesting than a human does. A human can make mental pictures of it all. A dog can smell it all. We experience various smells, do we not, both pleasant and unpleasant, but a dog has many kinds of smell. Just think how a dog specializes in the sense of smell. Nowadays, we have police dogs. They are led to the place where something has been stolen. The dog immediately takes up the scent, follows it, and finds the person. All this is possible because there is really an immense variety, a whole world of scents for a dog, and the olfactory nerve carries these scents backward into the head, into the skull. If we were to draw the olfactory nerve of a dog, which passes through its nose, we should have to draw it going backward. In the human being, only a little piece at the bottom of it has remained. The rest of it has been metamorphosed and is here below the forehead. It is a metamorphosed, transformed olfactory nerve. And with this organ, we form our mental images. For this reason, we cannot smell like a dog, but we can make mental pictures. We bear within us the dog with its sense of smell, only this latter has been transformed into something else. And so it is with all animals. Let me make this clearer. There is a German philosopher, Schopenhauer, who wrote a book called The World as Will and Idea. This book is only intended for human beings. If it had been written by a dog of genius, it would have been called The World as Will and Smell, and I am convinced that this book would have been much more interesting than Schopenhauer's. You must look at the various forms of animals and describe them not as though each animal existed in isolation, but so that you always arouse in the children the thought, this is a picture of the human being. If you think of a human being altered in one direction or another, simplified or combined, then you have an animal. If you take a lower animal, for example a tortoise form, and put it on the top of a kangaroo, then you have something like a hardened head on the top, for that is the tortoise form, and the kangaroo below stands for the limbs of the human being. And so everywhere in the wide world you can find some connection between human beings and animals. You are laughing now about these things. That does not matter at all. It is quite good to laugh about them in the lessons also, for there is nothing better you can bring into the classroom than humor. And it is good for the children to laugh too, for if they always see the teacher come in with a terribly long face, they will be tempted to make long faces themselves and to imagine that is what a person has to do when sitting at a desk in a classroom. But if humor is brought in, and you can make the children laugh, this is the very best method of teaching. Teachers who are always solemn will never achieve anything with the children. So here you have the principle of the animal kingdom as I wished to put it before you. We can speak of the details later if we have time, but from this you will see that you can teach about the animal kingdom by considering it as a human being spread out into all the animal forms. This will give the child a very beautiful and delicate feeling, for as I have pointed out to you, children come to know of the plant world as belonging to the earth, and the animals as belonging to themselves. The children grow with all the kingdoms of the earth. They no longer merely stand on the dead ground of the earth, but on the living ground, for they feel the earth as something living. They gradually come to think of themselves standing on the earth as though they were standing on some great living creature, like a whale. This is the right feeling. This alone can lead them to a really human feeling about the whole world. So, regarding the animal, Children come to feel that all animals are related to humans, but that humans have something that reaches out beyond them all, where they unite all the animals in themselves. And all this idle talk of the scientists about the human being descending from an animal will be laughed at by people who have been educated in this way. But they will know that humankind unites it within itself, the whole animal kingdom. The human being is a synthesis of all the single members of it. As I have said, between the 9th and 10th year, human beings come to the point of discriminating between the self as subject and the outer world as object. There is now the distinction between the self and the surrounding world. Up to this time, you could only tell fairy stories and legends in which the stones and plants speak and act like human beings, for children did not yet differentiate between self and environment. But now that the differentiation is made, you must bring the children in touch with their environment on a higher level. You must speak of the earth on which we stand in such a way that the children cannot but feel how earth and plant belonged together as a matter of course. Then the children will get practical ideas for agriculture, and will know, for instance, that the farmer manures the ground because a certain life is needed in it, for one particular species of plant. The children will not then take a plant out of a botanical tin and examine it by itself, nor will they examine animals in an isolated way, but will think of the whole animal kingdom as the great analysis of a human being spread out over the whole earth. Thus we come to know ourselves as we stand on the earth as human beings, and how the animals stand in relationship to us. It is of very great importance that from the 10th year until toward the 12th year, you should awaken these thoughts of plant earth and animal person. Thereby the children can take their place in the world in a very definite way, with their whole life of body, soul, and spirit. All this must be brought through the feelings in an artistic way, for it is through learning to feel how plants belong to the earth and to the soil that children really become intelligent. Thinking will then be in harmony with nature. Through your efforts to show children how we relate to the animal world, you demonstrate how the force of will that is in all animals lives also in the human being, but differentiated in individualized forms suited to human nature. All animal qualities, all feeling of form that is stamped into the animal nature, lives in the human being. Human will receives its impulses in this way, and human beings thereby take their place rightly in the world according to their own nature. Why is it that people go about in the world today as though they had lost their roots? Anyone can see that people do not walk properly nowadays. They do not step properly, but drag their legs after them. They learn differently in their sports, but there, again, there is something unnatural about it. But above all, they have no idea how to think nor what to do with their lives. They know well enough what to do if you put them in front of a sewing machine or a telephone, or if an excursion or a world tour is being arranged. But they do not know what to do out of themselves, because their education has not led them to find their right place in the world. You cannot put this right by coining phrases about educating people rightly. You can do it only if in the concrete details you find the right way of speaking of the plants in their true relationship to the soil, and of the animals in their rightful place by the side of humankind. Then human beings will stand on the earth as they should, and will have the right attitude toward the world. This must be achieved in all your lessons. It is not only important, it is essential. It will always be a question of finding out what child development demands at each age of life. For this, you need real observation and knowledge of the human being. Think once again of the two things that I have discussed. And you will see that children up to their 9th or 10th year are really demanding that the whole world of external nature be made alive. Because children do not yet see themselves as separate from this external nature. Therefore, we tell them fairy tales, myths, and legends. We invent something ourselves for the things that are in our immediate environment, in order that in the form of stories, descriptions, and pictorial representations of all kinds, we may give children, in an artistic form, what is found within their own soul, in the hidden depths that children bring with them into the world. And then, after the 9th or 10th year, let us say between the 10th and 12th year, we introduce children to the animal and plant world, as has been described. We must be perfectly clear that the conception of causality, of cause and effect, that is so popular today, has no place at all in what children need to understand even at this age, at the 10th or 11th year. We are accustomed these days to consider everything in its relation to cause and effect. The education based on natural science has brought this about. But to talk to children under 11 or 12 about cause and effect, as is the practice in the everyday life of today, is like talking about colors to someone who is colorblind. You will be speaking entirely beyond children if you speak of cause and effect in the style that is customary today. First and foremost, children need living pictures where there is no question of cause and effect. Even after the 10th year, these conceptions should only be brought to them in the form of pictures. It is only toward the 12th year that children are ready to hear about causes and effects. And so those branches of knowledge that have principally to do with cause and effect in the sense of the words used today, the lifeless sciences such as physics and so forth, should not be introduced into the curriculum until between the 11th and 12th year. Before then, one should not speak to the children about mineralogy, physics, or chemistry. None of these things is suitable before this age. Now, regarding history, up to the 12th year, the child should be given pictures of single personalities and well-drawn, graphic accounts of events that make history come alive, not a historical review, where what follows is always shown to be the effect of what has gone before, the pragmatic method of regarding history, of which our culture has become so proud. This pragmatic method of seeking causes and effects in history is no more comprehensible to the child than colors to the colorblind. And moreover, one gets a completely wrong conception of life as it runs its course, if one is taught everything according to the idea of cause and effect. I should like to make this clear to you in a picture. Imagine a river flowing along like this, and there is a drawing. It has waves, but it would not always be a true picture if you make the wave C come out of the wave B, and this again out of the wave A. That is, if you say that C is the effect of B and B of A. There are, in fact, all kinds of forces at work below which throw these waves up. So it is in history. What happens in 1910 is not always the effect of what happened in 1909, and so on. But quite early on, children ought to have a feeling for the things that work in evolution out of the depths of the course of time, a feeling of what throws the waves up, as it were. But they can get that feeling only if you postpone the teaching of cause and effect until later on, toward the 12th year, and up to this time give them only pictures. Here again, this makes demands on the teacher's fantasy. But teachers must be equal to these demands, and they will be so if they have acquired a knowledge of the human being. This is the one prerequisite. You must teach and educate out of the very nature of the human being. And for this reason, education for moral life must run parallel to the actual teaching that I have been describing to you. So now, in conclusion, I would like to add a few remarks on this subject, for here, too, we must read from children's own nature how they should be treated. If you give children of 7 a conception of cause and effect, you are working against the development of their human nature. And punishments also are often opposed to the real development of their nature. In the Waldorf school, we have had some very gratifying experiences of this kind. What is the usual method of punishment in schools? A child has done something badly and consequently is required to stay in and do some arithmetic, for instance. Now, in the Waldorf school, we once had a rather strange experience. 3 or 4 children were told that they had done their work badly and must therefore stay in and do some sums, whereupon the others said, "But we want to stay and do sums too." For they had been brought up to think of arithmetic as something nice to do, not as something that is used as a punishment. You should not arouse in the children the idea that staying in to do sums is something bad, but that it is a good thing to do. That is why the whole class wanted to stay and do sums. So you must not choose punishments that cannot be regarded as such if the children are to be educated in a healthy way in their soul life. To take another example, Dr. Stein, a teacher at the Waldorf School, often thought of very good educational methods on the spur of the moment. He once noticed that his pupils were passing notes under the desk. They were not attending to the lesson, but were writing notes and passing them under their desks to their neighbors, who then wrote notes in reply. Now, Dr. Stein did not scold them for writing notes and say, "I shall have to punish you," or something of that sort. But quite suddenly, he began to speak about the postal system and give them a lecture on it. At first, the children were quite mystified as to why they were suddenly being given a lesson on the postal system, but soon they realized why it was being done. This subtle method of changing the subject made the children feel ashamed. They began to feel ashamed of themselves and stopped writing notes simply on account of the thoughts about the postal system that the teacher had woven into the lesson. Thus, to take charge of a class requires inventiveness. Instead of simply following stereotyped traditional methods, you must actually be able to enter into the whole being of the child. And you must know that in certain cases, improvement, which is really what we are aiming at in punishment, is much more likely to ensue if the children are brought to a sense of shame in this way, without drawing special attention to it or to any one child. This is far more effective than employing some crude kind of punishment. If teachers follow such methods, they will stand before the children actively in spirit, and much will be balanced out in the class that would otherwise be in disorder. The first essential for a teacher is self-knowledge. For instance, if a child blots his book or its desk because of impatience or anger with something a neighbor did, the teacher must never shout at the child for making blots and say, "You must not get angry. Getting angry is something a good person never does. A person should never get angry, but should bear everything calmly. If I see you getting angry once more, why, then I shall throw the inkpot at your head." If you educate like this, which is very often done, you will accomplish very little. Teachers must always keep themselves in hand, and above all must never fall into the faults that they are blaming the children for. But here you must know how the unconscious part of the child's nature works. A person's conscious intelligence, feeling, and will are all only one part of the soul life. In the depths of human nature, even in the child, there holds sway the astral body with its wonderful prudence and wisdom. Now it always fills me with horror to see a teacher standing in class teaching out of a book, or constantly referring to a notebook containing questions to ask the children. The children do not appear to notice this consciously, it is true, but if you are aware of these things, then you will see that they have subconscious wisdom and say to themselves, "My teacher does not know what I am supposed to be learning. Why should I learn what my teacher does not know?" This is always the judgment that is passed by the subconscious nature of children who are taught by their teacher out of a book. Such are the imponderable and subtle things that are so extremely important in teaching, where as soon as the subconscious of the child, the astral nature, notices that the teacher does not know something that is being taught, but has to look it up in a book first. Then the child considers it unnecessary to learn it either, and the astral body works with much more certainty than the upper consciousness of the child. These are the thoughts I wished to include in today's lecture. In the next few days, I will deal with special subjects and stages in the child's education. The end of Lecture 3.